World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards with a summary of headline news as received in New York.
Here are the latest developments. The Navy has announced the loss of America's largest submarine. Red Army troops have widened their gains in the Dnieper Basin and at other points on the Eastern Front. Allied bombers have blasted Japanese airdromes and harbor installations in the Solomons and New Britain. The British Eighth Army is pushing on toward the Marat Line, but there have been new Axis gains in central Tunisia. Now for news direct from French North Africa, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting.
This is Charles Collingwood in North Africa. The Germans have already dented our new Tunisian line. After we beat off an attack on the Kasserine Pass day before yesterday, the Germans attacked again yesterday, and this time they took the pass. Today's communique speaks of local enemy gains in this area, but we know they have the pass. Heavy fighting is still going on, and British armored forces have moved down to reinforce the American units in the Kasserine area. It is just possible that the Germans may not be able to hold on to their new gains. We can't tell until we know the results of today's fighting. At the moment, all we know is that the Germans have the Kasserine Pass. Yesterday, General Bergeret, the number two man in the French African government, told correspondents out here some facts on the number of political prisoners still in African camps. I think many people were surprised to learn that there are still 734 French communists in concentration camps here. Some of these are local communists, but most of them were arrested 3.5 years ago in France when Russia was in uneasy alliance with Germany. They were brought over here in 1940 after the fall of France. By far the most notable of these French communists were 27 deputies, representatives properly and popularly elected to the French Chamber of Deputies, which is equivalent to our Congress. When those 27 were arrested, it was a sensation which shook all France. In the years that have passed, France and the world forgot about the 27 until we arrived in North Africa and found them still in jail outside of Algiers. A couple of weeks ago, the communist deputies were released, and last week, I had a talk with some of their number. They were a little gray, a little blank from their years in prison. They'd been out a week, but they said they still got sick when they ate a heavy meal. They were a little bewildered at the new shape of things that had come about while they had been away, and they were searching desperately for some part to play in this new world. Meadow, a gray-headed old Union leader, a little seedy from prison life, kept saying, "There must be some way we can help the Allies. All we want to do is beat Germany." And Rocher, who is a quiet, thoughtful man, said, "After all, we represent thousands of people in France. They elected us. They still believe in us. They are worried and confused by what's happening. Why can't we go to the radio and talk to them and tell them that they must continue to believe in the Allies, that only one thing counts, and that is that Germany must be beaten?" The communist deputy sat in my hotel room talking like that for a long time. It was a pathetic interview. After 3.5 years, they'd come out of prison into a world that seemed full of hope. But there was nothing for them to do in that world. Or if there was, no one would let them do it. This is Charles Collingwood, returning you to New York.
More news in just a moment. But first, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
From all battlefronts, land, sea, and air, from all quarters of the globe, comes news of American fighting men in action. And with every dispatch, Admiral workers receive fresh inspiration. Admiral workers are producing radios for American fighting men. Radios which are now on the fighting fronts, welding forces together, helping units and men work as a team. Perhaps, at this instant, a Navy flyer with an Admiral-built radio in his plane is on patrol duty. He spots a Nazi submarine. He radios a report to his base. A destroyer, summoned by radio, speeds out to sea. It locates the submarine's exact position by means of a radio device. And when the submarine is sunk, The destroyer reports to its commander by radio. Admiral is building all types of radios used in such action as this, the best radios in the world, for neither our Army or Navy will accept anything less than the best. Both the Army and Navy know only too well this coordinated action of planes, ships, men, and weapons depends upon radio, and both insist upon getting the best radio equipment. Admiral will build such equipment to the limit of its capacity and keep on doing so until this war is won. After that, Admiral radios will again be made for the American home, each one worthy of carrying on the tradition that an Admiral is America's smart set. Now here once again is Doug Edwards.
Across the Atlantic, the British people are watching developments in India, where Mohandas Gandhi's condition grows worse. For a report on this news and other developments, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS London, John Daly reporting.
There are no new reports in London on Gandhi's fast, other than that his condition is growing more serious. Britain's weekend celebration of the 25th birthday of the Russian Red Army reached its high point this afternoon when British Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden addressed an enthusiastic audience packed into Albert Hall. Eden paid high tribute to the gallant Russian armies and said that never in its long history had the German army suffered a disaster like that at Stalingrad. At the beginning of his speech, he had a surprise, a message to the British people from Stalin. Stalin, on behalf of the armed forces of the Soviet Union, thanked the citizens of Great Britain for the celebration. Its effect, he said, would be to strengthen confidence in Russia that the moment is near when the combined armies of Britain and Russia, by joint operations, will smash the common enemy. The allusion to joint operations leaves little doubt that Stalin does not consider the North African diversion enough, but he is not alone in that. The Casablanca conferences between Roosevelt and Churchill brought a promise that Europe would be invaded soon. And here in England, the people are not worried about the present reverses in Tunisia because they have any doubts as to the final outcome there, but because they're afraid the upsetting of the timetable in Tunisia will hold back the planned invasion of the European continent. Although we may have to wait for a land offensive against Europe, the Allied air offensive against Europe is well on its way right now. I have just returned from a bomber station of the United States Army 8th Air Force, a station from which flying fortresses fly across the English Channel to bomb Nazi sub-bases and industrial centers by daylight. It's a dirty, nasty job, and we're losing planes and men. I talked to an American squadron leader at that bombing station who had lost one of his planes in a raid over Europe, and he had something he wanted me to tell you. He received a brave, pathetic letter from the mother of one of the boys on a fortress that was lost. She gave her boy for the cause of freedom because it was necessary. But, she said, I have been told that the British have taken all our good planes and given us old, inferior ships to use. Was my boy in one of those old ships? That squadron leader told me to tell you to rack that up as another piece of dirty Nazi propaganda. He told me to tell you that they are flying American planes, the best that you at home build. But he said they needed more of them, and it was up to you to see that they got them. This is John Daly in London. I return you now to CBS New York.
The Russians celebrated the 21st anniversary of the Red Army today by rolling on unhalted toward the Dnieper River. Moscow's latest bulletin places Russian forces in the river basin within 34 miles of Dnipropetrovsk and Poltava. And all along the 500-mile front from Oryol to Krasnodar, the Red Armies report victories which have left almost 2,000 dead Germans on the battlefields. Yesterday's capture of the important rail junctions of Pavlograd and Krasnograd disrupts all direct German communications between Kharkov and the Donetsk Basin regions to the south. In the Donetsk area, the Russians continue to mop up remaining German troops. The Red Army reports the capture of a number of villages west of Rostov and southwest of Voroshilovgrad. And the Russians claim they repelled Nazi counterattacks in the Krasno-Armeysk region. Soviet forces advancing from Krasnograd have stormed more towns, killing 400 Germans and capturing supplies. To the north, on the Oryol front, midway between Moscow and Kharkov, the Russians report gains despite strong enemy resistance. At one point, German automatic riflemen seized a town, but Red troops surrounded the enemy and wiped out every man. On the fighting in the Caucasus, the Russians report the capture of a district center 17 miles west of Krasnodar. The German version of the fighting on the Eastern Front is vague as usual. The Nazis say they repelled attacks in the area of Rzeszów, the strong German base 130 miles northwest of Moscow. And the enemy communique said Russian pressure slackened at several points between Oryol and the Azov Sea because of a break in the weather and heavy losses. Meantime, Moscow and other Russian cities rang with speeches and jubilation in celebration of the Red Army's anniversary. Patriotic slogans are displayed everywhere. A typical one says, "Hail to the victory of the Anglo-Soviet-American alliance over the base enemies of humanity, the German fascist enslavers." Back in this country, most of us have given little attention to our Coast Guard, despite its day and night alert. For an on-the-spot account of these activities, Admiral Radio takes you now to a Coast Guard patrol boat in Lower New York Bay, Bill Slocum, Jr., reporting.
Old New York's grimy streets and depressing masses of skyscraper loom only a few short miles from me now, and they are the most beautiful thing I have ever seen in all this world. Say what you want about them, they do not bounce, and this overgrown canoe the Coast Guard calls a patrol boat combines the worst features of an airplane and a submarine. Actually, the little beast moves with considerable speed, and when it does, there isn't too much unpleasantness. But it is on anchorage patrol in the busiest harbor in the world, and that means every so often it sidles up to a freighter and wallows around while expert Coast Guardsmen make quite sure the freighter is where it belongs and is doing nothing it shouldn't do. Another, whether there are hundreds of boats in the harbor or whether there is a dozen, is a little matter the censors feel should be a secret between them, myself, and the thousands who travel in ferries. But as anybody who lives in a harbor town can tell you, as dusk falls, sometimes you'll see the harbor fill. When dawn comes, it is practically empty. And another convoy of death and destruction for the Axis and food and warmth for the Allies is on its way. It's the job of the Coast Guard Harbor Patrol to see to it that these freighters, many of them Liberty ships, take on their precious cargo without interference as they clear this harbor in as much secrecy as possible. These Coast Guardsmen are a combination seagoing policemen and firemen. They ferret all over the waterfront on foot, in boats, in jeeps, and in airplanes. And if they see anything amiss, they are all trained to nip it in the bud and keep damage to a minimum. The boat I'm on is on anchorage patrol. There are other Coast Guard units who see that only accredited citizens are given access to the waterfront. Others keep their eyes open for fire hazards, and they're all better than expert hands at mob and riot control. We're going to hear this crew in action shortly, I'm sure, because we're bearing down now on a big freighter, swinging at anchor and loaded to the gunwales with, shall we say, general cargo. I'd like to give you a picture of this harbor when it's filled, and that doesn't mean it's filled now, nor does it mean it's empty. The last time I was out, the Richelieu was laying sleek and trim amidst a couple of hundred travel-stained freighters. Some shiny new Liberties, other rugged old tramps, all of them low in the water and with cargoes piled high on their deck. All of them with life rafts and all of them armed, fore and aft. There's plenty of opportunity for a little high-class sabotage in this harbor. But that sabotage problem is the Coast Guard's. And to the naked eye, it looks like the saboteur is having a pretty bad season. We're coming up under the nose of a freighter now. Let's see how it works out.
Check this, please. Flag. Victor. Love. That's right.
Our captain is hailing the boat through a loudspeaker. In a minute, we will hear an answer from that boat.
That's the right hoist. He's alongside now.
We'll hear an answer in just 1 second now as the captain speaks through the loudspeaker. I don't know whether you can hear it or not. Here he is now.
Ahoy the vessel!
Hello!
Is the master aboard?
Hello!
Who are you?
Chief officer.
We're going to move you to a new berth. Stand by to get underway at 16:30. The pilot will be aboard at 1600. Your hoist is the same.
Sounds simple, doesn't it?
Thank
but
you.
Remember, no boat gets in this harbor without military scrutiny, and the Coast Guardsman asking those questions already knew the answers. He just wanted to make sure the boys aboard the boat knew them too. I return you now to CBS in New York and Doug Edwards.
Across the Pacific, our land, sea, and air forces continue their battle against the Japanese. For news from this war zone, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Honolulu, Webley Edwards reporting.
There is a significance in the Navy's report of an attack on Attu Island by surface ships that may be missed by the casual observer. Attu Island is at the tip of the Aleutian Peninsula, which juts in a long line of islands to the southwest of Alaska. It comes to mind that that's up north somewhere. That's true, it is up north. But the Aleutians are very definitely a part of our Pacific front against Japan. They are the right end of our line, so to speak, just as Guadalcanal is our left end. The center of this long Pacific line has been static since the Japs attempted to punch through Midway to Hawaii and were rolled back. Then the forces of Admiral Chester W. Nimitz made a hazardous but successful attack at the left end in the Solomons. Guadalcanal is now fully occupied and is a strong point for our forces. And now this weekend, Pacific Fleet units have gone into action at the other end of the line up north. There's been previous action in the Aleutians. There was an attack up there on Jap installations at Kiska by our surface ships in August of 1942. But this is the first shelling of Jap installations on Attu Island, which is 300 miles west of Kiska and more than 600 miles west of Dutch Harbor, Alaska. Attu is 1,800 miles west of the meridian that goes through Hawaii, although well north of here. But this is the main significance. Attu is less than 800 miles in a direct line west to Asiatic land, Kamchatka. And Kamchatka borders on the Jap-owned Kuril Islands, which extend some 800 miles southwesterly to Japan proper. This is the furthest west our surface ships have struck. It indicates that the Pacific Fleet is not only willing to take offensive action in enemy-controlled waters, but also able to do so. This Pacific reporter is no Pollyanna. I've been pretty pessimistic at times in reporting from this area for the last 14 months. There have been tremendous obstacles for our Pacific Fleet to overcome since its first attacking task force went out and hit the Japs in the Gilbert and Marshall Islands a little over a year ago. This Pacific War has been called a holding operation with a kick in it, and aptly. But the kick is beginning to develop. The offensive spirit has developed rapidly since Midway last June. Our fleet in the Solomons tried to provoke a decisive battle with the Japs down there the other day, but the Japs were cagey. They did not choose to fight. They will have to fight before very long because the fleet will see to it that they do. When that fight comes, we will be hurt. But you cannot fight battles like these in the Pacific without losing men and ships. But the Japs will be hurt worse. The men in the Pacific Fleet will bet you on that. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. We'll return you to CBS in New York.
In this country, the Navy has announced the loss of our largest submarine, and the nation is awaiting the OPA announcement of point values for rationed foods. For these developments, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Washington, Lee White reporting.
The 2,700-ton mine-laying submarine Argonaut, the largest of our fleet and possibly the largest in the world, has failed to return from patrol operations and is therefore presumably lost. A Navy communique says next of kin have been notified. The same communique also identifies the destroyer mentioned in communique number 282 as having been sunk in the Solomons on February 1st. She was the 2,100-ton De Haven, commissioned only last September, the Navy says, and she was sunk by Japanese dive bombers. It's hard to visualize the fact, but the De Haven, one of our newest and fastest destroyers, weighed 800 tons less than the missing submarine. Loss of life on the destroyer is believed to have been small, but if the Argonauts really lost, she doubtless went down with all her normal complement of between 90 and 100 men. In the Solomons, our planes are still attacking the airdromes at Munda and Vila, and in the Aleutians, our surface vessels have sunk a Japanese freighter. At 7 o'clock tonight, the Office of Price Administration will answer one of the questions uppermost in the minds of American housewives. How many cans of food will be available per person under the new rationing program? I know, but reporters have been pledged to silence until tonight, when the OPA will announce the number of points per month each person will be entitled to, and the respective value in points of some 200 processed foods, canned, frozen, and bottled. Until a week from tomorrow, none of these foods will be legally available for sale, Meanwhile, all Americans will be expected to register for ration book number 2. I now return you to CBS New York and Doug Edwards.
This week, the magazine editor and publisher reported that casualties among American correspondents in this war have been proportionately 4 times greater than among our armed forces. And the greater part of these reporter casualties have occurred in the Southwest Pacific. Here in New York is CBS correspondent William J. Dunn, just back from 2 years on the battlefronts in the Far East and the Southwest Pacific. Tell us, Bill, just how do you war correspondents operate out there?
The correspondents who are now working in the Southwest Pacific, and this goes for the South Pacific too, are a pretty great bunch of fellows on the whole. Even the loss of such men as Mel Jacoby, Barney Darnton, and Jack Singer fails to flag their enthusiastic desire to get in wherever the action is. Proof of this can be found in the stringent regulations General MacArthur's public relations officers have had to put into effect to keep the entire press corps from moving in a body to any front that might open. Vern Hoagland of the Associated Press is typical. Vern, you remember, had to make a parachute jump from a plane over New Guinea last August. It took him 41 days to find help. 41 days during which he wandered the jungles and the mountains almost without food and with very little water. Yet the first time I saw Vern after he left the hospital, he told me his one desire was to get back to New Guinea, and he did. The boys who do get to the fronts have very few advantages over the fighting men. They eat the same food. They drink the same chlorinated swamp water. They wade through mud and sleep on the ground, and they often get shot at. These boys have one inviolable rule at the front, a rule which requires the newcomer to dig his own foxhole as soon as he arrives. In a hot, steamy jungle with nothing but a small spade to use, that in itself is an all-day job, particularly for those of us who happen to tip the scales above the 200 mark. I think it's rather indicative of the attitude of these fellows that you never hear any complaints from them when they are actually up in the danger zone. When they get back to Port Moresby, where living conditions are glorious by comparison with the jungles, then they open up with a barrage of howls that are as loud as they are meaningless. Incidentally, one of the first things I learned in New Guinea is that any correspondent returning to press headquarters at Moresby from the jungles is expected to take a bath. And fast. In the early days of the Buna campaign, some of the boys had a tendency to come out of the jungle, clad in uniform coating of green dungarees and mud. Having lived in this outfit for weeks, they sometimes failed to realize its possibilities and rested a bit before changing. The entire press corps combines today to prevent any such oversight by the returning correspondent.
That was CBS correspondent William J. Dunn, who has just returned from Australia. Now, here's a message from our sponsor. Admiral dealers have requested that we ask you to be patient when your radio requires service. Every effort is being made to put all radios brought to Admiral dealers in tip-top shape. But doing so sometimes takes a little longer these days. Certain parts, including tubes, are difficult to obtain. And often, this means a radio out of action for a few days. There is a method by which you can usually avoid such delays, however. Tell your Admiral dealer to put your name on his list. Have him check your radio twice a year regularly. Such checkups enable him to tell in advance whether or not the vital parts of your set are holding up. If he sees one which can't last much longer, he'll start looking for a replacement immediately and probably have it in time so that your radio stays in continuous action without missing a single day or a single favorite program. Admiral dealers have the backing of the entire Admiral organization. And Admiral, in peacetime, is the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers. So tomorrow, first thing, call your Admiral dealer. Ask him to check your radio twice a year regularly. You'll be glad you did. 2 hand grenades will blow a Nazi machine gun crew to kingdom come. And 2 hand grenades can be bought for 8 25-cent war stamps. Let's fill every space in those stamp books again this month. Buy war stamps in addition to your 10% payroll allotment. Give American fighters the extras they need. Give yourself the extra war bond you want to own. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave, direct from the leading news centers of the world. Warren Sweeney speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Era Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.